From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. One shark expert recently described these sea creatures as the most poorly understood megafauna, not just because of popular culture with the movie Jaws in its canon, never mind Shark Week, but because the travel patterns of sharks cover great distances. Today, we're here to, yes, debunk some of those pop culture myths, but more importantly, to find out what kind of shark research is taking place in and around the waters of North Carolina. All three experts with us today have been obsessed with sharks since they were tiny. One remembers telling her mother when she was five she wanted to be an ichthyologist who studies sharks. Another slept with a stuffed toy shark as a child and dreamed of becoming a marine biologist. And the third, quote, always wanted to be a marine biologist and admired the top predator. Kara Yopak, a comparative neurobiologist in the Department of Biology and Marine Biology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, studies the brains of sharks. Kara Yopak, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. It's really exciting to be here.
Martin Benavides works with bonnethead sharks. He is a PhD student at the UNC Institute of Marine Sciences in the Coastal Fisheries, Oceanography, and Ecology Lab. Martin Benavides, welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on the show.
And we're also very glad to have with us today Madeline Marins, an aquarist at the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher and a master's student at UNCW who researched sand tiger sharks that live near shipwrecks off Cape Fear. Madeline Marins, thanks for being here today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And we'd like you to be part of this conversation. If you have a question about sharks for our researchers today, you can reach us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Since all three of you have been obsessed with sharks since you were tiny, what gene do you carry that allows you to see these creatures as something fascinating versus a scary giant creature with teeth that can hurt people? And I'd like all three of you to chime in on this, but let's start with Kara Yopak. When you look at a great white shark, what do you see that maybe the rest of us don't?
Well, I see perfect design. I see sort of an evolutionary marvel. Sharks have existed for over 400 million years, and they're obviously doing something right. Personally, I study the brain of these animals, and there's a number of remarkable features of a shark brain that are actually very similar to our own. So when I look at a great white shark, I don't see something fearful. I see something that keeps our oceans healthy, something that represents very early evolution of our own brains, and something that's worthy of protection.
Madeline Marins, what do you see?
I think every child grows up being obsessed with sharks and dinosaurs, and maybe for the three of us, we just never really grew out of that. And you go to the ocean and you're just fascinated by this whole other element that you're not used to. You're stepping into some other territory, and it's just something just so fascinating about that perfect design, as Kara said, of this shark that is just so out of our element, and it's just something I've always been fascinated with.
Martin Benavides, you've actually had a chance to look into other things like accounting and finance and economics, and you came back to sharks. Why?
I would say that I never lost my fascination for sharks. I definitely came back to marine biology because I felt like it was something that I could do where I wouldn't actually feel like I had to work. You know, and that's one of those, I guess, age-old sayings that you hear. If you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life. And so that was what brought me back to it. But I'm just going to kind of echo what's already been said in terms of why I was fascinated with sharks. They're masters of their domain. And that, to me, is fascinating. You know, I spent a lot of time as a child drawing sharks, perfecting my skills at drawing them, trying to get every detail of their body correct. And I think that, you know, like I said, kind of echoes what was said earlier. They've had a lot of time to perfect those body structures, evolutionarily speaking.
Let's give our listeners sort of a thumbnail sketch of the history of the ebb and flow of the population of sharks in recent decades. Was it maybe the 1980s or 1990s where there seemed to be a pretty serious decline in the shark population? Now we hear all these different species are coming back. Kara Yopak, can you speak to the decline of the shark population and what happened there?
Well, personally, my research doesn't really focus as much on population dynamics. I think what I can speak to is individual species are very different, and that each species needs to be managed and regulated by fisheries quotas, and there are certain populations in decline and then some that are on the rise.
Martin Benavides.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with what Kara said, and I would add that if you look at sort of the past several decades, what you see is sort of a pattern that reflects changes that we've made as a society with respect to sharks. So in the 1970s, we opened up the shark longline commercial fishery, and that obviously led to increases in the number of sharks that we were taking from the ocean. And then, as you mentioned, in the 80s and 90s, we started to see the decline of some of the larger species. And as Kara mentioned, you know, all of these species have different life history dynamics, and some of the larger species are the ones that are the latest to reach sexual maturity, take the longest to grow to their full size and reach adulthood. So they are the most severely impacted by these increases in fishing pressure. And what happened as a result of that was some really good legislation was enacted in our country, and so we've started to see the return of some of these large shark species in some of the data that's come out recently.
What would we lose if some of these sharks were allowed to go extinct? Why are they so important to the ocean's ecosystem? Madeline Marins.
I think sharks in the ocean are is a healthy ocean. So, you know, as top predators, they help keep a balance in the food chain, you know, having direct and indirect impacts on prey species. You know, if they're feeding on the sick and the weak, you know, they're, as someone once put it, the lions of the ocean. They help keep balance to these ecosystems.
And so can you, I know this would be speculation, and scientists, researchers don't like to do that, but just for the purpose of illustration, what kinds of things would then burgeon, grow, flourish in the ocean that possibly shouldn't, that would throw things out of balance? Martin.
Yeah, so to answer that question, I'd first like to start by pointing out that this is analogous to what we've seen, and by that I mean it's similar to what we've seen in some terrestrial environments. And the one that I always like to use as an example is Yellowstone, because I think everybody's heard about sort of the wolf, elk, and aspen sort of trophic cascade, which is what that means is as you deplete one level of the food chain, it causes the next level to increase, which then puts more pressure on the level beneath it. And we actually have seen this happen with some species of sharks. I'll give you an example from our survey, which is a mesopredatory shark called the Atlantic sharp-nosed shark, which was pretty infrequently caught towards the beginning of our survey. And I'll just introduce the survey because I haven't had a chance to do that yet. So the UNC Institute of Marine Sciences has been running a longline survey since the early 1970s. And so we've had a really unique opportunity, at least here in North Carolina, to kind of see some of these changes in action throughout the last few decades. And what we've seen is, as I mentioned before, a decline of the large sharks by at least 50%. And for some species, it was much higher, upwards of 90%. And then we've seen mesopredatory sharks, and that's a term basically meaning the level beneath these large sharks, not the top predators, but sort of the mid-level predators. Some of those have started to increase in numbers. And one example from our survey that has become the most frequently caught is the Atlantic sharp-nosed shark. And so you start to see that these mid-level predators increase in numbers, And the thought is that that can put pressure on the food levels, the levels of the food chain beneath that, which can, in some cases, lead all the way down to the very base of the food chain. So I believe I've heard of an example with tiger sharks that actually led all the way down to the organisms that ate the algae off the reef being depleted, and then coral reefs started to be overgrown with algae. And I don't know the specifics of exactly which links in the food chain were affected, but my point is that it sort of reverberates all the way down the food chain.
And we have just a couple minutes before we go to this first break. And when we come back, I promise you we're going to get into the research and we're going to talk a lot about shark brains and what we're learning about tiger sharks and bonnet heads. But we did have a call from Jeremy. He wants to know, what advice do you have on avoiding sharks while swimming in the ocean, which is a very human, legitimate question, for a beach town. Martine?
Yes. So I would just start by saying, I understand that there is a concern, particularly here in North Carolina, as we've seen recently with the number of shark encounters. And I understand that concern, and I don't want to discredit that. But I also want to say that, it should be seen as encouraging in terms of our ocean ecosystem and how it's sort of rebounding from some of the things that have happened in the past. But to directly answer the question,
which you might need to do,
yes,
after the
break, I would say that the only way to completely avoid shark encounters is to stay out of the water. It's their domain. When we enter that, we have to realize that we're out of ours. And there's a few other things statistically speaking, but I'll get back to that.
Great. Thank you. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're learning about sharks today from three people who've been obsessed with them from childhood and who are now bona fide experts. Kara Yopak of UNCW's Marine Biology Department, Madeline Marins of the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher, and Martine Benavidez of the UNC Institute for Marine Sciences. They're all here today, and they're taking your questions on this Thursday. Call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're learning about one of the most elusive and misunderstood creatures in the sea, the apex predator, the shark. And we have three experts with us today with three different areas of research. Martine Benavidez studies bonnethead sharks as a PhD student at the UNC Institute for Marine Sciences. Madeline Marins looked at sand tiger sharks off the Cape Fear coast. She is a master's student at UNCW, and she's now with the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher. And Kara Yopak studies shark brains as a comparative neurobiologist at UNCW. And they're welcoming your questions on this Thursday. You can call us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And in just a moment, we're going to talk to Liz from Holly Ridge. But first, Martine Benavidez, you were about to explain to our listeners what they need to know about avoiding sharks when they're swimming in the ocean.
Yeah, and thank you for the opportunity to follow up on that. I want to stress that I'm not saying that everybody needs to stay out of the water because there are sharks in the water. They're more comfortable in the water. For us, it's a foreign environment. And most of what it takes to be in the right mindset to avoid this is just being aware of your surroundings when you do enter the water. So I was speaking about, statistically speaking, there's a few things that you can do to kind of avoid the factors that lead to, I guess, it becoming more likely for you to get attacked. One would be, and I just want to step back and use a different word. I like to use the word shark bite. a few things you can do to avoid shark bites. One would be to always swim in a group. Okay, it's much more likely for them to encounter somebody when they're by themselves. They like to stay away from a lot of activity from humans. Don't wander far from shore. Make sure that you're not isolating yourself from being able to be assisted in the case of an encounter. And also to, think about the times of day that you're swimming. Sharks are more active during the early hours or the late hours when there's low light. And then also,
what does that mean? Is that, can we put a time on that?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, sunset, dusk, not a good time to be in the water, early morning hours. And then, you know, some very common sense things, like if you're bleeding, it's probably not a good time to get in the water. If you see people chumming or a bunch of bait fish, you know, it's maybe a good time to be very aware of your surroundings and probably exit the water if you actually see a shark. That would be sort of my advice.
Madeline Marant.
And I think one thing to remember, too, that's really important is we are not on the menu for these animals. These are not man-eaters going after us and attacking us. Many of the times it's misidentity. So maybe the water isn't clear and they just bump into us. You know, millions of people are on the beaches and swimming. I mean, statistically, some of my favorite things are you're more likely to be injured by a toilet seat or be bit by a New Yorker, which is my favorite because I'm from
New Yorker.
You guys are all more likely to be bit by me than a shark. But millions of people are on the beach, you know, not getting attacked. People are diving off the coast of North Carolina without any negative interactions.
Martine.
And just to kind of piggyback on that comment, one thing that I always like to point out is that, you know, we have on average about 3,500 deaths every year from drowning. So, you know, just by entering the water, you are putting yourself at much more risk of you know, becoming fatally injured than if you were to encounter or than the risk of encountering a shark. But so the risk is kind of blown out of proportion a lot of times in the public's mind. If you look at it proportional to the other risks that were mentioned.
Maybe because it's just such a primal fear. It may be planted in some of us by Jaws, but the idea that something can eat you.
Yeah.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're learning about sharks off the North Carolina coast today. We're about to get into more about why these apex predators are so misunderstood and why it's complicated to even gather data on them. With us now to answer your questions on this Thursday, Kara Yopak. She's a comparative neurobiologist at UNCW. Martine Benavides, who studies bonnethead sharks as a PhD student at the UNC Institute for Marine Sciences. And Madeline Marantz, who studied sand tiger sharks off the North Carolina coast. She's now an aquarist at the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher. And you can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. Or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Liz from Holly Ridge, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thanks. I'd like to ask the panel. I surf a lot, so I'm in the water when the waves are best early in the morning and after the wind dies down. Evening, I wear something called a shark band. It's a magnetic device encased in rubber. You can wear it on your wrist or your ankle. Do you folks think it's beneficial? It's supposed to repel sharks through a disruption of their magnetic navigational ability.
Kara Yopak, that's a good question, Liz, and I bet you a lot of our listeners are wondering the same thing. There are all kinds of shark repellent ideas out there. Kara. Right.
Thank you so much for your question. First of all, you touched on a really important point, which is that sharks have a unique sense that's rather foreign to us, which is that they have electroreceptors. So they can actually detect minute electric fields in the water. So that's some of the science that this supposed deterrent is based on. However, in terms of looking at a repellent or some sort of device like this, the important thing is to look into the scientific literature. Has this device actually been tested by an independent group? Is there data that's able to speak to its effectiveness? Something that we were working on quite a lot when I was at the University of Western Australia was looking at effectiveness of various shark deterrents. So there is literature out there, and I'd really encourage you to do some reading into some devices that might be more effective. However, one thing that I sort of always say is that the idea of a Lord of the Rings style repellent, which is one repellent to rule them all, isn't really accurate. So there are hundreds of species of shark. They're all relying on their sensory systems, but oftentimes they rely on different sensory systems to a differing degree. So there is a lot that we need to understand about the biology of these animals before we can really understand how we would be able to repel them.
Thank you so much for your question, Liz. Kara Jopak, that leads right into what you're learning about sharks when you examine their brains and some of the variances in shark brains. But there is a conception out there, I think, that sharks are just these big sort of lumbering consumers who don't see very well and will, you know, as Madeline suggested, misidentify and take a chunk out of someone because they thought it was maybe a fish. Can you talk a little bit about that perception and if that's accurate, if it applies to certain species?
Absolutely. A question that I get most often is when people find out I study comparative neuroanatomy is, are sharks smart? And to be honest, that's my least favorite question of all time, because what does it actually mean to be smart? How do you quantify that? What I like to say is that each species is incredibly well adapted to be very successful in the environment in which they inhabit. Now, sharks do have a reputation for being these small-brained, pre-programmed eating machines, but a lot of my research shows that sharks actually have relative brain sizes, so the size of their brain relative to their body, that are comparable to birds and mammals. And the brains of different species actually look quite different to one another. So we're talking difference in the size or the relative proportion of certain regions of the brain that receive input from a different sense. So you can look at the regions of the brain responsible for smell or for vision or for electroreception. And what we're finding is that these differences in the brain suggest that the relative importance of these different sensory systems varies between species. So, for example, in the great white shark, they actually have incredibly large visual brain regions and are likely much more of a visual predator than other species. Deep sea sharks, for example, their visual brain regions are actually quite small. And what's large is the electroreceptive brain regions, suggesting a specialization of non-visual senses in a deep, dark environment where there's not a lot of light and therefore vision isn't really going to be advantageous. So each species, in all likelihood, they all share the same senses, but they're probably varying in how much they rely on each sense.
How many different senses do sharks have? You mentioned deep sea sharks having electroreceptors and relying more on those than sight, but are there other senses that sharks who can't see very well might use?
Absolutely. So sharks have a number of senses that we have. For example, they can smell, they can see, they can respond to cutaneous touch. They also have something called a latreline. So latreline is how they can detect motion in the water around their body. And then again, they have electroreceptors, which is how they can detect minute electric fields in the water. So all animals are going to give off minute electric fields, and sharks at a very close range can actually detect these fields and zero in on a prey item.
Now, you mentioned they feel things. How did you describe that? They have sensory.
Yes.
That's not the right term.
It's called mechanoreception. So there's a number of different ways that you can respond to touch. So latreline, you can think of as a distant touch. So it's not actually something touching the surface of the shark's skin. But sharks also will have, much like us, mechanoreceptors. So in our skin, in our fingertips, on our arm, on our back, we have mechanoreceptors that respond to different kinds of stimulation. So when you run your fingers over the surface of sandpaper, for example, you can tell that that is a different surface than if you run your fingers over glass. And it's because your mechanoreceptors are firing and responding to different texture.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're learning about sharks around the world and off the North Carolina coast today and what researchers are learning about them and why they are so misunderstood. You just heard Kara Jopak. She's a comparative neurobiologist and assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. We have Martin Benavides here today. He studies bonnethead sharks as a PhD student at the UNC Institute for Marine Sciences. And also here is Madeline Marins, who is a master's student at UNCW. She studied sand tiger sharks off the North Carolina coast, and she's now an aquarist at the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Why is it that it has been historically so difficult to gather data on sharks, Madeline Marins?
That is a good question. One thing is that a lot of them are highly migratory, and they're in a different element. I was saying, in the marine environment, one, it is very difficult to study the marine environment. Getting out on a boat, you have to deal with weather, time, resources. And, you know, until recent years, a lot of that equipment needed had been really expensive. So that's one thing for sure. And two is these animals are very cryptic, right? So they're camouflaged, they're moving around. Many are highly migratory. They're in North Carolina one day, then they're going up the coast up into Cape Cod. So they're not staying in one place. So we've been having to figure out how do we track them over long distances and over long times. And, you know, I think the key is to finding predictable patterns in their movements. So first we can't even, you know, we have to figure out where they are to be able to study them. And I think that's been the first step. And I think there's been leaps and bounds in that in recent years. And we're starting to figure out where they are and gathering some baseline data.
And how are we doing that?
So one thing I'm looking at is acoustic telemetry. So there's these electronic tags. They're not just used on sharks. They started out in the terrestrial environment and then moved into the marine environment. So you'll see them on fish and sea turtles. And so these electronic tags give off a specific unique code. And then we put hydrophones in the water. They're just like microphones, and they'll pick up these unique codes. So when that animal's nearby that receiver or that microphone, we're able to see little pinpoints of where they are. So that's what I'm looking at. You can also use satellite tracking and other ways like that.
And what are you learning about the migratory patterns of which sharks, and what's different about what you're learning than what we might have thought before?
Right. So I'm looking at sand tiger sharks and specifically mature females. So sand tigers are found all over the world, but there is a U.S. East Coast population, and they're going up and down the East Coast. But it's not just random. There does seem to be predictable patterns in what they're doing. And the juveniles and the adults seem to be doing their own thing, but also the mature females seem to be doing their own thing. So my research is based off a collaborative study that started in Delaware Bay, and they found that this is a critical habitat for adult populations, but they were seeing a low proportion of mature females returning to this area.
To the Delaware Bay
area? To the Delaware Bay. And North Carolina coast is this really productive habitat. There's it's known as the graveyard of the Atlantic. So there's all these shipwrecks and artificial reefs that are a great ecosystem for prey species. And then you see these top predators coming in. So it's a great pit stop. But we also think that there may be year-round residents of mature females. And what's really important about mature females is they're the ones potentially breeding and giving birth to future generations of sharks. And sand tiger sharks are a threatened species. They're slow growing, take a long time to mature, and they're only giving birth to one or two pups at a time, and then every other year. So your top predators that you're seeing these dramatic declines in is due to the fact that they're harder for them to rebound because they're not reproducing as much. So these mature females are really important to the population and to understand what they're doing.
Just to be clear, when you say sand tiger shark, is that different from what we colloquially call a tiger shark?
It is. They are two different species, actually. The tiger shark has those stripes. They have those serrated teeth. They're known to be one of those top predators that eat anything from seabirds to garbage has been found in their stomachs. Sand tiger sharks actually have these very pointed teeth, and they're actually only known to be fish eaters. And they have this fearsome appearance, but they're found all over our shipwrecks, and people come from all over the world every summer to come dive with these sharks, and they've been found to come and reappear every summer, but we don't know what these sand tigers are doing. I would love to figure it out.
Martin Benavides, you're also using this, what's the term, acoustic telemetry? to gather data on sharks. And what are you learning about bonnet heads?
So as you pointed out, I am interested in the bonnet head shark. And
actually, just tell us what that is for people who haven't heard of that shark.
I'll just take a moment to say that I had not been aware of the bonnet head shark before I started this project, and it's quickly become the most fascinating species of shark in my mind.
Why?
Well, for one, it's a member of the hammerhead shark family, which is one of the most derived of shark families, and it's actually the most derived species within that family. So they're sort of evolutionarily speaking, you know, one of the most highly evolved, and they're very specialized for their prey. So they eat, at least the ones that we see here in North Carolina, primarily blue crabs, and I'd say that that's the case for most of the bonnet heads we find in the United States Atlantic coast. And they're very highly specialized with electroreception, which is one of the things that was brought up earlier. In their cephalofoil, which is what we call the hammer, that they're able to use to find their prey underneath the sediments. And so because they eat primarily blue crabs, they're also tied to a lot of the inshore coastal habitats that a lot of people are very concerned about here, especially in North Carolina, because they're nursery habitats for other species such as seagrass beds, oyster reefs. And so I find them very fascinating for a number of different reasons. But one of the things that we're trying to figure out is what are sort of their residency patterns? When are they here with us in North Carolina? How long is that period? What are their movements sort of within the estuary? And also trying to figure out, you know, what kind of individualization there might be there.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a shark exploration today with three experts. When we come back from this break, it'll be your last chance to ask your own question on this Thursday. We'll also hear from Bob from Southport. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. You're listening to Coastline. You are listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. On today's edition, we're taking a dive, oh yeah, I did it, into the world of sharks, particularly those found off the North Carolina coast. Here to answer your questions are Madeline Marins of the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher, Martine Benavides of the UNC Institute for Marine Sciences, and Kara Yopak of UNCW's Biology and Marine Biology Department. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Martine Benavides, just before we went to break, you were explaining about what you're really looking for in this next phase of research around bonnet heads.
Yeah, so to answer your question, I would say that there's two things sort of that have emerged early on, and I'm still in the early phases of data analysis, so I'll have to confirm this once I've analyzed all the data. But it first of all, appears that North Carolina bonnet heads are returning to particular estuaries for food year after year. Now, this is not a new finding for the species. This has been noted in other areas such as Florida and South Carolina. But it is interesting to see that pattern is also reflected here in North Carolina. And possibly more interesting, emerging from looking at sort of the finer scale movements, is that when they return to these particular estuaries, they seem to sort of divide up the estuary so that they can share the available food by minimizing competition. So, particular bonnet heads will kind of have an affinity to one certain area of the estuary, and that's sort of a general pattern that's emerged.
Kara Yopak, why do you think bonnet heads have such cool brains?
Well, I can't help myself as a comparative neuroanatomist. Whenever anyone starts talking about their study species, I immediately start thinking about its brain. and hammerheads particularly have really, really large brains relative to their body size. Usually when people come to my lab, my party trick is to put out the brain of a hammerhead shark and the great white, and I ask them to tell me which one they think is the great white, and they always think it's the hammerhead because it's so large and looks quite impressive next to the brain of the actual great white, which is actually relatively small.
Can you describe the size of a mature bonnet head, or hammerhead rather, brain? Like, how big would you compare it to? A basketball, a baseball?
Oh, goodness. That's getting large. Slightly smaller than a baseball, for sure. So when people think about what the brain of a shark looks like, I usually find they think it's a miniature version of our brain. In fact, shark brains are long and thin, almost like a spark plug. But a hammerhead brain is actually much more rounded, and a lot of that is owing to a large part of the brain that deals with things like spatial learning and memory and social intelligence. So if you've ever seen a video of hammerhead sharks, they're often in schools, they have complex courtship and mating rituals, they segregate by sex and size, and so we can see behaviors like that reflected in the brain. And that's why I personally love looking at the brain, because I think it informs ecology and behavior, and then other researchers' work on ecology and behavior informs my research.
Why do you say that human brains aren't so different from shark brains?
Very good question. I will not bore you with a neuroanatomy lecture right now. What I will say is that sharks were the first to possess what we call the vertebrate brain blueprint. So there are six major brain regions that are shared across all vertebrates, and sharks were the first to have it. And a number of characteristics of our own brains actually originated in sharks. So I kind of say that sharks figured something out very early in evolution, and then a lot of those characteristics persist across all vertebrate species.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's an exploration of sharks with researchers. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Bob from Southport, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. Questions about evolution, particularly the place where the evolution of sharks and the evolution of hominids intersect, and the duration of evolution of sharks. I assume that's a lot longer than the evolution of hominids, and shark-human interaction has probably been minimal until the past, say, 1,000 years, and how has their interaction with us, or vice versa, affected their evolutionary patterns? Thank you.
What a great question, Bob. Does anyone want to take a crack at it, Martine?
I'll try. I would say that it's probably too early to tell. I think that there has been some sort of concerning patterns seen, and not just within sharks, I would say across all fisheries, in terms of, fish are starting to change their sexual maturity patterns, reproduce at an earlier age, mature at a smaller size. And so the question, I guess, becomes, is that something that will drive evolution in a longer term sense? But like I said, I think it's probably too early to tell.
We don't know that yet. Kara.
So I'd also like to speak to, building on Martine's point, about something called anthropogenic disturbances. So not on the timescale of evolution, but on a shorter timescale, there's a lot of, human-induced environmental changes that have been happening in the ocean.
Such as
dredging that can cause a lot of sediment in the water, or increased turbidity in the water. One thing that's very interesting about fish and sharks in general is that their bodies, their brains, they grow forever. And so they're what we call highly plastic. So we have actually seen in certain studies in highly turbid environments, changes, for example, to the visual system that can be an adaptation as a result of not being able to rely on vision quite as much. I completely agree. It's far too soon to tell, but I do believe that there are likely to be impacts based on these anthropogenic disturbances.
So when you say that the brains are highly plastic, that means they adapt more rapidly to changes in their environment than, say, our brains might.
Yes. So one thing that's very different about our brains and all mammalian brains is that we don't experience a lot of turnover of neurons in adulthood. Most of our neurogenesis is very early in development. Sharks and fish and some amphibians and reptiles actually experience lifelong neurogenesis. So they're generating new neurons constantly. So I think this actually makes them much more susceptible to environmental disturbances because of this plasticity or this ability to add new neurons constantly.
Sam writes, just curious, when does a shark sleep or do they sleep? Kara.
This is a very good question. It's probably one of the most popular questions that we get. It is an area of ongoing research, although it's not something we know a lot about. There are definitely videos that you can find all over YouTube of what we consider sleeping, but it really comes down again to the biology and what do you define as sleeping. There is some research by a PhD student back in my old university who is looking into this very thing. By recording from the brain during a period of what might be considered sleep. So watch this space.
Okay, we will. And we have Ben from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline, Ben. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. A few of you said that you were studying the migratory patterns of the sand tiger and bonnethead. I'm just wondering, are there benefits of using acoustic telemetry versus satellite tracking?
Yeah,
do you get a finer resolution of data points with acoustic telemetry?
Absolutely.
That's so, Madeline Marins. Go ahead.
Thank you. Great question. So we chose that with the sand tiger shark. They do spend a lot of time down in the water and aren't breaching to the surface. So for satellite, like a lot of what you'll hear with O-Search, you know, with some of their charismatic white sharks, with Mary Lee and tiger sharks, they'll come up to the surface a lot. And you need... the satellite tag goes on their dorsal fin, and it goes up to the satellite. With sand tiger sharks, they're not breaching as much, so it is much more opportunistic to have these hydrophones in the water to be able to pick up where they're going.
Martine Benavides.
Well, I would just add from a practical standpoint the cost. You know, it's very cost prohibitive when satellite tags cost, you know, $5,000 or upwards of $5,000, and it's much... you can get more tags for a smaller amount of money. And, you know, I would echo the same thing with bonnet heads. They're not often coming to the surface. So, you know, we want to get data when they're underwater for long periods of time as well.
Madeline.
And our sand tiger sharks, I should add as well, they're actually internal tags. So a lot of times with your external tags, you can get biofouling and it may affect the behavior or may shed and only last a couple years or maybe a couple months and malfunction. With these internal tags, we just do a quick non-surgical procedure, and these internal tags last up to 10 years in these sharks to get some long-term data from them that way.
We have an email from Jamie who writes, I got kicked off the Curie Beach Pier Facebook page because I objected to people fishing for sharks off the pier. From what I can tell, they just torture the animal for however long it takes to bring it in and then release it. I don't think they eat the sharks. What does your guest have to say about this practice? Also, every pier has no shark fishing sign, but everyone seems to ignore it. And there is a theory, I don't know that we ever established this, that some of the shark bites that happened in 2015 were the result of people possibly fishing for sharks near a swimming area. But that's a separate issue. What about shark fishing off the pier? This is a local issue that we're talking about. Madeline.
Sure. So I would say for recreational fishing, you know, you don't always target sharks, and sometimes they will, you know, show up on the line. Fishing piers, there's a lot of fish moving around, and it might attract sharks to the area. And I know NOAA does provide safe handling courses. There's a YouTube video they actually just distributed for people. You know, if you do get a shark on the line, there's ways to just handle it with minimal fight time and minimal restraint and just cutting the line loose. But you definitely want to, we have seen in some research that, you know, longer fight times and a lot of restraint may cause mortal injury to those sharks, you just want to decrease that as much as possible.
Kara Yopak, you, when you were comparing shark brains to human brains, you told our producer that one of the differences between shark and human brains is that shark brains don't have the same, don't have a consciousness the way we think of human consciousness. And that was sort of a head scratcher for me. I realize that anthropomorphization, I messed up, I don't know, I can't say that word. That's a trap for scientists. I get that. But on the other hand, how do you know that? How do you define consciousness? What are you saying when you make that statement?
That's a very good question. It actually always comes back to the neuroanatomy. So again, I will not go into crazy technical details, but sharks don't have a neocortex, which is essentially the region of the brain, subregions of the neocortex that we associate with consciousness on a human level. I think these kinds of questions always come up, and we naturally start to want to understand an animal based on what we understand about ourselves. But I think the important thing is to know that we can't necessarily apply the way that we perceive the world to the way that other animals perceive the world. We need to be very careful about attributing those kinds of characteristics to animals and study them in their own right.
Okay, so this is a hokey question that might bother researchers. But have you ever seen people, researchers, connect with sharks? I've seen video of people scratching sharks when they're flipped over underwater, understanding there's a lot of their nerve endings in their nose. Kara, you're looking at me sort of skeptically. Like, is that a thing? Can they be like puppies if you handle them properly?
Again, I think there is a need to want to connect with an animal in order to understand it. And we naturally want to believe there is an emotional connection. And I think that that's a very dangerous line of thinking. And again, if you go back to the biology of the animal, oftentimes if you flip a shark over, it goes into what we call tonic immobility. So this kind of behavior doesn't mean you are emotionally connecting with an animal the way you would a puppy, and you're scratching it and therefore it turns over because it wants more. And again, I think that there's something very important about having a healthy respect for animals in the ocean. And if the goal is to educate ourselves and to mitigate risk and mitigate factors, I think trying to interact with an animal is only increasing your risk of having a negative animal-human interaction, not even sharks. If you were to do that with any animal in the wild, you'd be increasing your risk.
That is such a good answer. We have an email from Roy who says, what obstacles do the panelists face when trying to conduct their research, and what can listeners do to help? We don't have a lot of time left. Martine.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I'm just trying to think real quick about that. You go ahead.
I can jump in.
Madeline, yeah.
Starting out as a master's student, I'm really learning the ropes. So I've faced a lot of challenges just starting out. And what I spoke to earlier as time and money and Mother Nature can be so unforgiving when you're going out into the marine environment. You're not just in a lab. You're having to, you know, we're right in hurricane season and I'm right in my prime tagging season. So I would say that's a big thing. But you just have to be relentless, and you know, universities and the aquariums, you know, have these great resources to provide for researchers, and we've come a long way and are figuring out those obstacles and to be able to answer these questions.
Well, I was just going to say, it occurred to me because I wanted to try to address the second point of that question. You know, our survey, we tag every shark that we get with a plastic tag. And I would say that, you know, as has been mentioned earlier on the show, one of the biggest issues is just finding our sharks, being able to access them. And so if anybody finds a tagged shark, please report that, you know, to the information that is on the tag.
It's a great point. That is this edition of Coastline. Kara Yopak, Madeline Marins, Martine Benavides, thank you all so much for joining us today. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. You can get the podcast or find it on the WHQR app. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2. Join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.